inquiry, "How much of a fortune has Midas Mulligan amassed in this valley?"
He pointed ahead. "Judge for yourself." The road was winding through stretches of unleveled soil toward the homes of the valley. The homes were not lined along a street. They were spread at irregular intervals over the rises and hollows of the ground. They were small and simple, built of local materials, mostly of granite and pine, with a prodigal ingenuity of thought and a tight economy of physical effort. Every house looked as if it had been put up by the labor of one man. No two houses were alike, and the only quality they had in common was the stamp of a mind grasping a problem and solving it. Galt pointed out a house once in a while, choosing the names she knew, and it sounded to her like a list of quotations from the richest stock exchange in the world, or like a roll call of honor. Ken Daniger, Ted Nielsen, Lawrence Hammond, Roger Marsh, Ellis Wyatt, Owen Kellogg, Dr. Axton. The home of Dr. Axton was the last, a small cottage with a large terrace, lifted on the crest of a wave against the rising walls of the mountains. The road went past it and climbed on into the coils of an ascending grade. The pavement shrank to a narrow path between two walls of ancient pines, their tall, straight trunks pressing against it like a grim colonnade, their branches meeting above, swallowing the path into sudden silence and twilight. There were no marks of wheels on the thin strip of earth. It looked unused and forgotten. A few minutes and a few turns seemed to take the car miles away from human habitation. And then there was nothing to break the pressure of the stillness but a rare wedge of sunlight cutting across the trunks in the depth of the forest once in a while. The sudden sight of a house on the edge of the path struck her like the shock of an unexpected sound. Built in loneliness, cut off from all ties to human existence, it looked like the secret retreat of some great defiance or sorrow. It was the humblest home of the valley, a log cabin beaten in dark streaks by the tears of many rains, only its great windows withstanding the storms with the smooth, shining, untouched serenity of glass.
"Whose house is—"
"Oh!" She caught her breath and jerked her head away. Above the door, hit by a ray of sun, its design blurred and worn, battered smooth by the winds of centuries, hung the silver coat of arms of Sebastian d'Anconia. As if in deliberate answer to her involuntary movement of escape, Galt stopped the car in front of the house. For a moment they held each other's eyes. Her glance was a question. His a command. Her face had a defiant frankness, his an unrevealing severity. She understood his purpose, but not his motive. She obeyed. Leaning on her cane, she stepped out of the car, then stood erect, facing the house. She looked at the silver crest that had come from a marble palace in Spain to a shack in the Andes to a log cabin in Colorado. The crest of the men who would not submit. The door of the cabin was locked. The sun did not reach into the glazed darkness beyond the windows, and pine branches hung outstretched above the roof like arms, spread in protection, in compassion, in solemn blessing. With no sound but the snap of a twig or the ring of a drop falling somewhere in the forest through long stretches of moments, the silence seemed to hold all the pain that had been hidden here, but never given voice. She stood, listening with a gentle, resigned, unlamenting respect. "Let's see who will do greater honor, you to Nat Taggart, or I to Sebastian d'Anconia. Dagny, help me to remain, to refuse, even though he's right." She turned to look at Galt, knowing that he was the man against whom she had had no help to offer. He sat at the wheel of the car. He had not followed her or moved to assist her, as if he had wanted her to acknowledge the past and had respected the privacy of her lonely salute. She noticed that he still sat as she had left him, his forearm leaning against the wheel at the same angle, the fingers of his hand hanging down in the same sculptured position. His eyes were watching her, but that was all she could read in his face, that he had watched her intently, without moving. When she was seated beside him once more, he said, "That was the first man I ever took away from you." She asked, her face stern, open, and quietly defiant,
How much do you know about that?
Nothing that he told me in words. Everything that the tone of his voice told me whenever he spoke of you. She inclined her head. She had caught the sound of suffering in the faintest exaggeration of evenness in his voice. He pressed the starter. The motor's explosion blasted the story contained in the silence, and they drove on. The path widened a little, streaming toward a pool of sunlight ahead. She saw a brief glitter of wires among the branches as they drove out into a clearing. An unobtrusive little structure stood against a hillside on a rising slant of rocky ground. It was a simple cube of granite, the size of a tool shed. It had no windows, no apertures of any kind, only a door of polished steel and a complex set of wire antennae branching out from the roof. Galt was driving past, leaving it unnoticed, when she asked with a sudden start, "What's that?" She saw the faint break of his smile. "The powerhouse."
"Oh, stop, please."
He obeyed, backing the car to the foot of the hillside. It was her first few steps up the rocky incline that stopped her, as if there were no need to move forward, no further place to rise. And she stood as in the moment when she had opened her eyes on the earth of the valley, a moment uniting her beginning to her goal. She stood looking up at the structure, her consciousness surrendered to a single sight and a single wordless emotion. But she had always known that an emotion was a sum totaled by an adding machine of the mind, and what she now felt was the instantaneous total of the thoughts she did not have to name, the final sum of a long progression, like a voice telling her by means of a feeling. If she had held on to Quentin Daniels, with no hope of a chance to use the motor, for the sole sake of knowing that achievement had not died on Earth, if, like a weighted diver sinking in an ocean of mediocrity, under the pressure of men with gelatin eyes, rubber voices, spiral-shaped convictions, non-committal souls and non-committing hands, she had held, as her lifeline and oxygen tube, the thought of a superlative achievement of the human mind. If at the sight of the motor's remnant, in a sudden gasp of suffocation, as a last protest from his corruption-eaten lungs, Dr. Stadler had cried for something, not to look down at, but up to, and this had been the cry, the longing and the fuel of her life. If she had moved, drawn by the hunger of her youth for a sight of clean, hard, radiant competence, then here it was before her, reached and done. The power of an incomparable mind given shape in a net of wires sparkling peacefully under a summer sky, drawing an incalculable power out of space into the secret interior of a small stone hovel. She thought of this structure, half the size of a boxcar, replacing the power plants of the country, the enormous conglomerations of steel, fuel, and effort. She thought of the current flowing from this structure, lifting ounces, pounds, tons of strain from the shoulders of those who would make it or use it, adding hours, days, and years of liberated time to their lives, be it an extra moment to lift one's head from one's task and glance at the sunlight, or an extra pack of cigarettes bought with the money saved from one's electric bill, or an hour cut from the workday of every factory using power, or a month's journey through the whole open width of the world, on a ticket paid for by one day of one's labor, on a train pulled by the power of this motor, with all the energy of that weight, that strain, that time replaced and paid for by the energy of a single mind who had known how to make connections of wire follow the connections of his thought. But she knew that there was no meaning in motors or factories or trains, that their only meaning was in man's enjoyment of his life, which they served, and that her swelling admiration at the sight of an achievement was for the man from whom it came, for the power and the radiant vision within him which had seen the earth as a place of enjoyment and had known that the work of achieving one's happiness was the purpose, the sanction, and the meaning of life. The door of the structure was a straight, smooth sheet of stainless steel, softly lustrous and bluish in the sun. Above it, cut in the granite, as the only feature of the building's rectangular austerity, there stood an inscription. "I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine." She turned to Galt. He stood beside her. He had followed her. He had known that this salute was his. She was looking at the inventor of the motor, but what she saw was the easy, casual figure of a workman in his natural setting and function. She noted the uncommon lightness of his posture, a weightless way of standing that showed an expert control of the use of his body. A tall body in simple garments, a thin shirt, light slacks, a belt about a slender waistline, and loose hair made to glitter like metal by the current of a sluggish wind. She looked at him as she had looked at his structure. Then she knew that the first two sentences they had said to each other still hung between them, filling the silence, that everything said since had been said over the sound of those words, that he had known it, had held it, had not let her forget it. She was suddenly aware that they were alone. It was an awareness that stressed the fact, permitting no further implication, yet holding the full meaning of the unnamed in that special stress. They were alone in a silent forest, at the foot of a structure that looked like an ancient temple, and she knew what rite was the proper form of worship to be offered on an altar of that kind. She felt a sudden pressure at the base of her throat. Her head leaned back a little, no more than to feel the faint shift of a current against her hair, but it was as if she were lying back in space, against the wind, conscious of nothing but his legs and the shape of his mouth. He stood watching her, his face still but for the faint movement of his eyelids drawing narrow as if against too strong a light. It was like the beat of three instants. This was the first, and in the next she felt a stab of ferocious triumph at the knowledge that his effort and his struggle were harder to endure than hers. And then he moved his eyes and raised his head to look at the inscription on the temple. She let him look at it for a moment, almost as an act of condescending mercy to an adversary struggling to refuel his strength. Then she asked, with a note of imperious pride in her voice, pointing at the inscription, "What's that?" "It's the oath that was taken by every person in this valley but you," she said, looking at the words. "This has always been my own rule of living." "I know it. But I don't think that yours is the way to practice it." "Then you'll have to learn which one of us is wrong." She walked up to the steel door of the structure with a sudden confidence faintly stressed in the movements of her body, a mere hint of stress, no more than her awareness of the power she held by means of his pain, and she tried, asking no permission, to turn the knob of the door. But the door was locked, and she felt no tremor under the pressure of her hand, as if the lock were poured and sealed to the stone with the solid steel of the sheet. "Don't try to open that door, Miss Taggart." He approached her, his steps a shade too slow, as if stressing his knowledge of her awareness of every step. "No amount of physical force will do it," he said. "Only a thought can open that door. If you tried to break it down by means of the best explosives in the world, the machinery inside would collapse into rubble long before the door would give way. But reach the thought which it requires, and the secret of the motor will be yours, as well as—" it was the first break she had heard in his voice— "as well as any other secret you might wish to know." He faced her for a moment, as if leaving himself open to her full understanding, then smiled oddly, quietly at some thought of his own, and added, "I'll show you how it's done." He stepped back. Then, standing still, his face raised to the words carved in the stone, he repeated them slowly, evenly, as if taking that oath once more. There was no emotion in his voice, nothing but the spaced clarity of the sounds he pronounced with full knowledge of their meaning. But she knew that she was witnessing the most solemn moment it would ever be given her to witness. She was seeing a man's naked soul and the cost it had paid to utter these words. She was hearing an echo of the day when he had pronounced that oath for the first time, and with full knowledge of the years ahead. She knew what manner of man had stood up to face 6,000 others on a dark spring night, and why they had been afraid of him. She knew that this was the birth and the core of all the things that had happened to the world in the 12 years since. She knew that this was of far greater import than the motor hidden inside the structure. She knew it, to the sound of a man's voice pronouncing in self-reminder and rededication, "I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine." It did not startle her. It seemed unastonishing and almost unimportant that at the end of the last sound, she saw the door opening slowly, without human touch, moving inward upon a growing strip of darkness. In the moment when an electric light went on inside the structure, he seized the knob and pulled the door shut, its lock clicking sealed once more. "It's a sound lock," he said. His face was serene. "That sentence is the combination of sounds needed to open it. I don't mind telling you this secret, because I know that you won't pronounce those words until you mean them the way I intended them to be meant." She inclined her head. "I won't." She followed him down to the car, slowly, feeling suddenly too exhausted to move. She fell back against the seat, closing her eyes, barely hearing the sound of the starter. The accumulated strain and shock of her sleepless hours hit her at once, breaking through the barrier of the tension her nerves had held to delay it. She lay still, unable to think, to react, or to struggle, drained of all emotions but one. She did not speak. She did not open her eyes until the car stopped in front of his house. "You'd better rest," he said, "and go to sleep right now if you want to attend Mulligan's dinner tonight." She nodded obediently. She staggered to the house, avoiding his help. She made an effort to tell him, "I'll be all right," then to escape to the safety of her room and last long enough to close the door. She collapsed, face down on the bed. It was not the mere fact of physical exhaustion. It was the sudden monomania of a sensation too complete to endure. While the strength of her body was gone, while her mind had lost the faculty of consciousness, a single emotion drew on her remnants of energy, of understanding, of judgment, of control, leaving her nothing to resist it with or to direct it, making her unable to desire, only to feel, reducing her to a mere sensation, a static sensation without start or goal. She kept seeing his figure in her mind, his figure as he had stood at the door of the structure. She felt nothing else, no wish, no hope, no estimate of her feeling, no name for it, no relation to herself. There was no entity such as herself. She was not a person, only a function, the function of seeing him, and the sight was its own meaning and purpose, with no further end to reach. Her face buried in the pillow, she recalled dimly, as a faint sensation, the moment of her takeoff from the flood-lighted strip of the Kansas airfield. She felt the beat of the engine, the streak of accelerating motion gathering power in a straight-line run to a single goal, and in the moment when the wheels left the ground, she was asleep. The floor of the valley was like a pool, still reflecting the glow of the sky, but the light was thickening from gold to copper, the shores were fading and the peaks were smoke-blue when they drove to Mulligan's house. There was no trace of exhaustion left in her bearing and no remnant of violence. She had awakened at sundown. Stepping out of her room, she had found Galt waiting, sitting idly motionless in the light of a lamp. He had glanced up at her. She had stood in the doorway, her face composed, her hair smooth, her posture relaxed and confident. She had looked as she would have looked on the threshold of her office in the Taggart Building, but for the slight angle of her body leaning on a cane. He had sat looking at her for a moment, and she had wondered why she had felt certain that this was the image he was seeing. He was seeing the doorway of her office, as if it were a sight long imagined and long forbidden. She sat beside him in the car, feeling no desire to speak, knowing that neither of them could conceal the meaning of their silence. She watched a few lights come up in the distant homes of the valley, then the lighted windows of Mulligan's house on the ledge ahead. She asked, "Who will be there?" "Some of your last friends," he answered, "and some of my first." Midas Mulligan met them at the door. She noticed that his grim, square face was not as harshly expressionless as she had thought. He had a look of satisfaction, But satisfaction could not soften his features. It merely struck them like flint and sent sparks of humor to glitter faintly in the corners of his eyes, a humor that was shrewder, more demanding, yet warmer than a smile. He opened the door of his house, moving his arm a shade more slowly than normal, giving an imperceptibly solemn emphasis to his gesture. Walking into the living room, she faced seven men who rose to their feet at her entrance. "Gentlemen." "Taggart Transcontinental," said Midas Mulligan. He said it smiling, but only half-jesting. Some quality in his voice made the name of the railroad sound as it would have sounded in the days of Nat Taggart, as a sonorous title of honor. She inclined her head slowly in acknowledgment to the men before her, knowing that these were the men whose standards of value and honor were the same as her own, the men who recognized the glory of that title as she recognized it, knowing with a sudden stab of wistfulness how much she had longed for that recognition through all her years. Her eyes moved slowly in greeting from face to face. Ellis Wyatt, Ken Daniger, Hugh Axton, Dr. Hendricks, Quentin Daniels. Mulligan's voice pronounced the names of the two others. Richard Halley, Judge Narragansett. The faint smile on Richard Halley's face seemed to tell her that they had known each other for years, as in her lonely evenings by the side of her phonograph, they had. The austerity of Judge Narragansett's white-haired figure reminded her that she had once heard him described as a marble statue, a blindfolded marble statue. It was the kind of figure that had vanished from the courtrooms of the country when the gold coins had vanished from the country's hands. "You have belonged here for a long time, Miss Taggart," said Midas Mulligan. "This was not the way we expected you to come, but welcome home." "No," she wanted to answer, but heard herself answering softly, "Thank you." "Dagny, how many years is it going to take you to learn to be yourself?" It was Ellis Wyatt, grasping her elbow, leading her to a chair, grinning at her look of helplessness, at the struggle between a smile and a tightening resistance in her face. "Don't pretend that you don't understand us. You do." "We never make assertions, Miss Taggart," said Hugh Axton. "That is the moral crime peculiar to our enemies. We do not tell. We show. We do not claim. We prove. It is not your obedience that we seek to win, but your rational conviction. You have seen all the elements of our secret. The conclusion is now yours to draw. We can help you to name it, but not to accept it. The sight, the knowledge, and the acceptance must be yours." "I feel as if I know it," she answered simply, "and more. I feel as if I've always known it, but never found it. And now I'm afraid. Not afraid to hear it, just afraid that it's coming so close." Axton smiled. "What does this look like to you, Miss Taggart?" He pointed around the room. "This?" She laughed suddenly, looking at the faces of the men against the golden sunburst of rays filling the great windows. "This looks like... You know, I never hoped to see any of you again. I wondered at times how much I'd give for just one more glimpse or one more word. And now... Now this is like that dream you imagine in childhood, when you think that some day in heaven you will see those great departed whom you had not seen on earth, and you choose from all the past centuries the great men you would like to meet." "Well, that's one clue to the nature of our secret," said Axton. "Ask yourself whether the dream of heaven and greatness should be left waiting for us in our graves, or whether it should be ours here and now, and on this earth." "I know," she whispered. "And if you met those great men in heaven," asked Ken Daniger, "what would you want to say to them?" Just hello, I guess." "That's not all," said Daniger. "There's something you'd want to hear from them." "I didn't know it either until I saw him for the first time." He pointed to Galt, and he said it to me. And then I knew what it was that I had missed all my life. Miss Taggart, you'd want them to look at you and to say, well done. She dropped her head and nodded silently, head down, not to let him see the sudden spurt of tears to her eyes. All right, then. Well done, Dagny. Well done. Too well. And now it's time for you to rest from that burden which none of us should ever have had to carry. Shut up, said Midas Mulligan, looking at her bowed head with anxious concern. But she raised her head, smiling. Thank you, she said to Daniger. If you talk about resting, then let her rest, said Mulligan. She's had too much for one day. No, she smiled. Go ahead, say it, whatever it is. Later, said Mulligan. It was Mulligan and Axton who served dinner, with Quentin Daniels to help them. They served it on small silver trays to be placed on the arms of the chairs, and they all sat about the room, with the fire of the sky fading in the windows and sparks of electric light glittering in the wine glasses. There was an air of luxury about the room, but it was the luxury of expert simplicity. She noted the costly furniture, carefully chosen for comfort, bought somewhere at a time when luxury had still been an art. There were no superfluous objects, but she noticed a small canvas by a great master of the Renaissance, worth a fortune. She noticed an oriental rug of a texture and color that belonged under glass in a museum. This was Mulligan's concept of wealth, she thought, the wealth of selection, not of accumulation. Quentin Daniels sat on the floor with his tray on his lap. He seemed completely at home, and he glanced up at her once in a while, grinning like an impudent kid brother who had beaten her to a secret she had not discovered. He had preceded her into the valley by some 10 minutes, she thought, but he was one of them, while she was still a stranger. Galt sat aside beyond the circle of lamplight on the arm of Dr. Axton's chair. He had not said a word. He had stepped back and turned her over to the others, and he sat watching it as a spectacle in which he had no further part to play. But her eyes kept coming back to him, drawn by the certainty that the spectacle was of his choice and staging, that he had set it in motion long ago, and that all the others knew it as she did. She noticed another person who was intensely aware of Galt's presence. Hugh Axton glanced up at him once in a while, involuntarily, almost surreptitiously, as if struggling not to confess the loneliness of a long separation. Axton did not speak to him, as if taking his presence for granted. But once, when Galt bent forward and a strand of hair fell down across his face, Axton reached over and brushed it back, his hand lingering for an imperceptible instant on his pupil's forehead. It was the only break of emotion he permitted himself, the only greeting. It was the gesture of a father. She found herself talking to the men around her, relaxing in light-hearted comfort. No. She thought, what she felt was not strain. It was a dim astonishment at the strain which she should but did not feel. The abnormality of it was that it seemed so normal and simple. She was barely aware of her questions as she spoke to one man after another, but their answers were printing a record in her mind, moving sentence by sentence to a goal. "The Fifth Concerto?" said Richard Halley, in answer to her question. I wrote it 10 years ago. We call it the Concerto of Deliverance. Thank you for recognizing it from a few notes whistled in the night. Yes, I know about that. Yes, since you knew my work, you would know when you heard it that this concerto said everything I had been struggling to say and reach. It's dedicated to him. He pointed to Galt. Why, no, Miss Taggart, I haven't given up music. What makes you think so? I've written more in the last 10 years than in any other period of my life. I will play it for you, any of it, when you come to my house. No, Miss Taggart, it will not be published outside. Not a note of it will be heard beyond these mountains. "No, Miss Taggart, I have not given up medicine," said Dr. Hendricks in answer to her question. "I have spent the last 6 years on research. I have discovered a method to protect the blood vessels of the brain from that fatal rupture which is known as a brain stroke. It will remove from human existence the terrible threat of sudden paralysis. No, not a word of my method will be heard outside.
The law, Miss Taggart, said Judge Narragansett.
What law? I did not give it up. It has ceased to exist. But I am still working in the profession I had chosen, which was that of serving the cause of justice. No, justice has not ceased to exist. How could it? It is possible for men to abandon their sight of it, and then it is justice that destroys them. But it is not possible for justice to go out of existence, because one is an attribute of the other. Because justice is the act of acknowledging that which exists. Yes, I am continuing in my profession. I am writing a treatise on the philosophy of law. I shall demonstrate that humanity's darkest evil, the most destructive horror machine among all the devices of men, is non-objective law. No, Miss Taggart. My treatise will not be published outside. My business, Miss Taggart, said Midas Mulligan. My business is blood transfusion, and I'm still doing it. My job is to feed a life fuel into the plants that are capable of growing. But ask Dr. Hendricks whether any amount of blood will save a body that refuses to function, a rotten hulk that expects to exist without effort. My blood bank is gold. Gold is a fuel that will perform wonders, but no fuel can work where there is no motor. No, I haven't given up. I merely got fed up with the job of running a slaughterhouse where one drains blood out of healthy living beings and pumps it into gutless half-corpses.
Given up, said Hugh Axton.
Check your premises, Miss Taggart. None of us has given up. It is the world that has. What is wrong with a philosopher running a roadside diner, or a cigarette factory, as I am doing now? All work is an act of philosophy, and when men will learn to consider productive work, and that which is its source, as the standard of their moral values, they will reach that state of perfection which is the birthright they lost. The source of work? Man's mind, Miss Taggart. Man's reasoning mind. I am writing a book on this subject, defining a moral philosophy that I learned from my own pupil. Yes, it could save the world. No, it will not be published outside.
Why? She cried. Why? What are you doing, all of you?
We are on strike, said John Galt. They all turned to him as if they had been waiting for his voice and for that word. She heard the empty beat of time within her, which was the sudden silence of the room as she looked at him across a span of lamplight. He sat slouched casually on the arm of a chair, leaning forward, his forearm across his knees, his hand hanging down idly. And it was the faint smile on his face that gave to his words the deadly sound of the irrevocable. Why should this seem so startling? There is only one kind of men who have never been on strike in human history. Every other kind and class have stopped when they so wished, and have presented demands to the world, claiming to be indispensable. Except the men who have carried the world on their shoulders, have kept it alive, have endured torture as sole payment, but have never walked out on the human race. Well, their turn has come. Let the world discover who they are, what they do, and what happens when they refuse to function. This is the strike of the men of the mind, Miss Taggart. This is the mind on strike. She did not move except for the fingers of one hand that moved slowly up her cheek to her temple. Through all the ages, he said, the mind has been regarded as evil, and every form of insult, from heretic to materialist to exploiter, every form of iniquity, from exile to disfranchisement to expropriation, every form of torture, from sneers to rack to firing squad, have been brought down upon those who assumed the responsibility of looking at the world through the eyes of a living consciousness and performing the crucial act of a rational connection. Yet only to the extent to which, in chains, in dungeons, in hidden corners, in the cells of philosophers, in the shops of traders, some men continued to think, only to that extent was humanity able to survive. Through all the centuries of the worship of the mindless, whatever stagnation humanity chose to endure, whatever brutality to practice, it was only by the grace of the men who perceived that wheat must have water in order to grow, that stones laid in a curve will form an arch, that two and two make four, that love is not served by torture and life is not fed by destruction. Only by the grace of those men did the rest of them learn to experience moments when they caught the spark of being human, and only the sum of such moments permitted them to continue to exist. It was the man of the mind who taught them to bake their bread, to heal their wounds, to forge their weapons, and to build the jails into which they threw him. He was the man of extravagant energy and reckless generosity who knew that stagnation is not man's fate, that impotence is not his nature, that the ingenuity of his mind is his noblest and most joyous power. And in service to that love of existence he was alone to feel, he went on working, working at any price, working for his despoilers, for his jailers, for his torturers, paying with his life for the privilege of saving theirs. This was his glory and his guilt, that he let them teach him to feel guilty of his glory, to accept the part of a sacrificial animal and, in punishment for the sin of intelligence, to perish on the altars of the brutes. The tragic joke of human history is that on any of the altars men erected, it was always man whom they immolated and the animal whom they enshrined. It was always the animal's attributes, not man's, that humanity worshipped. The idol of instinct and the idol of force, the mystics and the kings. The mystics, who longed for an irresponsible consciousness and ruled by means of the claim that their dark emotions were superior to reason, that knowledge came in blind, causeless fits, blindly to be followed, not doubted. And the kings, who ruled by means of claws and muscles, with conquest as their method and looting as their aim, with a club or a gun as sole sanction of their power. The defenders of man's soul were concerned with his feelings, and the defenders of man's body were concerned with his stomach, but both were united against his mind. Yet no one, not the lowest of humans, is ever able fully to renounce his brain. No one has ever believed in the irrational. What they do believe in is the unjust. Whenever a man denounces the mind, it is because his goal is of a nature the mind would not permit him to confess. When he preaches contradictions, he does so in the knowledge that someone will accept the burden of the impossible. Someone will make it work for him at the price of his own suffering or life. Destruction is the price of any contradiction. It is the victims who made injustice possible. It is the men of reason who made it possible for the rule of the brute to work. The despoiling of reason has been the motive of every anti-reason creed on earth. The despoiling of ability has been the purpose of every creed that preached self-sacrifice. The despoilers have always known it. We haven't. The time has come for us to see. What we are now asked to worship, what had once been dressed as God or King, is the naked, twisted, mindless figure of the human incompetent. This is the new ideal, the goal to aim at, the purpose to live for, and all men are to be rewarded according to how close they approach it. This is the age of the common man, they tell us. A title which any man may claim to the extent of such distinction as he has managed not to achieve. He will rise to a rank of nobility by means of the effort he has failed to make. He will be honored for such virtue as he has not displayed, and he will be paid for the goods which he did not produce. But we who must atone for the guilt of ability, we will work to support him as he orders, with his pleasure as our only reward. Since we have the most to contribute, we will have the least to say. Since we have the better capacity to think, we will not be permitted a thought of our own. Since we have the judgment to act, we will not be permitted an action of our choice. We will work under directives and controls, issued by those who are incapable of working. They will dispose of our energy because they have none to offer, and of our product because they can't produce. Do you say that this is impossible, that it cannot be made to work? They know it, but it is you who don't, and they are counting on you not to know it. They are counting on you to go on, to work to the limit of the inhuman, and to feed them while you last. And when you collapse, there will be another victim starting out and feeding them while struggling to survive. And the span of each succeeding victim will be shorter. And while you'll die to leave them a railroad, your last descendant in spirit will die to leave them a loaf of bread. This does not worry the looters of the moment. Their plan, like all the plans of all the royal looters of the past, is only that the loot shall last their lifetime. It has always lasted before, because in one generation they could not run out of victims. But this time, it will not last. The victims are on strike. We are on strike against martyrdom, and against the moral code that demands it. We are on strike against those who believe that one man must exist for the sake of another. We are on strike against the morality of cannibals, be it practiced in body or in spirit. We will not deal with men on any terms but ours. And our terms are a moral code which holds that man is an end in himself and not the means to any end of others. We do not seek to force our code upon them. They are free to believe what they please. But for once, they will have to believe it and to exist without our help. And once and for all, they will learn the meaning of their creed. That creed has lasted for centuries solely by the sanction of the victims, by means of the victims' acceptance of punishment for breaking a code impossible to practice. But that code was intended to be broken. It is a code that thrives not on those who observe it, but on those who don't. A morality kept in existence not by virtue of its saints, but by the grace of its sinners. We have decided not to be sinners any longer. We have ceased breaking that moral code. We shall blast it out of existence forever by the one method that it can't withstand, by obeying it. We are obeying it. We are complying. In dealing with our fellow men, we are observing their code of values to the letter and sparing them all the evils they denounce. The mind is evil. We have withdrawn the works of our minds from society, and not a single idea of ours is to be known or used by men. Ability is a selfish evil that leaves no chance to those who are less able. We have withdrawn from the competition and left all chances open to incompetence. The pursuit of wealth is greed, the root of all evil. We do not seek to make fortunes any longer. It is evil to earn more than one's bare sustenance. We take nothing but the lowliest jobs, and we produce, by the effort of our muscles, no more than we consume for our immediate needs, with not a penny nor an inventive thought left over to harm the world. It is evil to succeed, since success is made by the strong at the expense of the weak. We have ceased burdening the weak with our ambition and have left them free to prosper without us. It is evil to be an employer. We have no employment to offer. It is evil to own property. We own nothing. It is evil to enjoy one's existence in this world. There is no form of enjoyment that we seek from their world, and this was hardest for us to attain. What we now feel for their world is that emotion which they preach as an ideal. Indifference. The blank. The zero. The mark of death. We are giving men everything they've professed to want and to seek as virtue for centuries. Now let them see whether they want it.
It was you who started this strike?
She asked. I did. He got up. He stood, hands in pockets, his face in the light, and she saw him smile with the easy, effortless, implacable amusement of certainty. We've heard so much about strikes, he said, and about the dependence of the uncommon man upon the common. We've heard it shouted that the industrialist is a parasite, that his workers support him, create his wealth, make his luxury possible. And what would happen to him if they walked out? Very well. I propose to show to the world who depends on whom, who supports whom, who is the source of wealth, who makes whose livelihood possible, and what happens to whom when who walks out. The windows were now sheets of darkness, reflecting the dots of lighted cigarettes. He picked a cigarette from a table beside him, and in the flare of a match she saw the brief sparkle of gold, the dollar sign between his fingers. I quit and joined him and went on strike, said Hugh Axton, because I could not share my profession with men who claim that the qualification of an intellectual consists of denying the existence of the intellect. People would not employ a plumber who would attempt to prove his professional excellence by asserting that there's no such thing as plumbing. But apparently the same standards of caution are not considered necessary in regard to philosophers. I learned from my own pupil, however, that it was I who made this possible. When thinkers accept those who deny the existence of thinking as fellow thinkers of a different school of thought, it is they who achieve the destruction of the mind. They grant the enemy's basic premise, thus granting the sanction of reason to formal dementia. A basic premise is an absolute that permits no cooperation with its antithesis and tolerates no tolerance. In the same manner and for the same reason as a banker may not accept and pass counterfeit money, granting it the sanction, honor, and prestige of his bank, just as he may not grant the counterfeiter's demand for tolerance of a mere difference of opinion, so I may not grant the title of philosopher to Dr. Simon Pritchett, or compete with him for the minds of men. Dr. Pritchett has nothing to deposit to the account of philosophy except his declared intention to destroy it. He seeks to cash in, by means of denying it, on the power of reason among men. He seeks to stamp the mint mark of reason upon the plans of his looting masters. He seeks to use the prestige of philosophy to purchase the enslavement of thought. But that prestige is an account which can exist only so long as I am there to sign the checks. Let him do it without me. Let him, and those who entrust to him their children's minds, have exactly that which they demand. A world of intellectuals without intellect, and of thinkers who proclaim that they cannot think. I am conceding it. I am complying. And when they see the absolute reality of their non-absolute world, I will not be there, and it will not be I who will pay the price of their contradictions. Dr. Axton quit on the principle of sound banking, said Midas Mulligan. I quit on the principle of love. Love is the ultimate form of recognition one grants to superlative values. It was the Hunsacker case that made me quit. That case when a court of law ordered that I honor, as first right to my depositors' funds, the demand of those who would offer proof that they had no right to demand it. I was ordered to hand out money earned by men to a worthless rotter whose only claim consisted of his inability to earn it. I was born on a farm. I knew the meaning of money. I had dealt with many men in my life. I had watched them grow. I had made my fortune by being able to spot a certain kind of man. The kind who never asked you for faith, hope, and charity, but offered you facts, proof, and profit. Did you know that I invested in Hank Reardon's business at the time when he was rising, when he had just beaten his way out of Minnesota to buy the steel mills in Pennsylvania? Well, when I looked at that court order on my desk, I had a vision. I saw a picture, and I saw it so clearly that it changed the looks of everything for me. I saw the bright face and the eyes of young Reardon as he'd been when I'd met him first. I saw him lying at the foot of an altar, with his blood running down into the earth. And what stood on that altar was Lee Hunsaker, with the mucus-filled eyes, whining that he'd never had a chance. It's strange how simple things become once you see them clearly. It wasn't hard for me to close the bank and go. I kept seeing, for the first time in my life, what it was that I had lived for and loved. She looked at Judge Narragansett. You quit over the same case, didn't you? Yes, said Judge Narragansett. I quit when the Court of Appeals reversed my ruling. The purpose for which I had chosen my work was my resolve to be a guardian of justice. But the laws they asked me to enforce made me the executor of the vilest injustice conceivable. I was asked to use force to violate the rights of disarmed men, who came before me to seek my protection for their rights. Litigants obey the verdict of a tribunal solely on the premise that there is an objective rule of conduct, which they both accept. Now I saw that one man was to be bound by it, but the other was not. One was to obey a rule, the other was to assert an arbitrary wish, his need, and the law was to stand on the side of the wish. Justice was to consist of upholding the unjustifiable. I quit, because I could not have borne to hear the words Your Honor addressed to me by an honest man. Her eyes moved slowly to Richard Halley, as if she were both pleading and afraid to hear his story. He smiled. I would have forgiven men for my struggle, said Richard Halley. It was their view of my success that I could not forgive. I had felt no hatred in all the years when they rejected me. If my work was new, I had to give them time to learn. If I took pride in being first to break a trail to a height of my own, I had no right to complain if others were slow to follow. That was what I had told myself through all those years. Except on some nights, when I could neither wait nor believe any longer, when I cried, "Why?" but found no answer. Then, on the night when they chose to cheer me, I stood before them on the stage of a theater, thinking that this was the moment I had struggled to reach, wishing to feel it, but feeling nothing. I was seeing all the other knights behind me, hearing the why, which still had no answer, and their cheers seemed as empty as their snubs. If they had said, "Sorry to be so late, thank you for waiting," I would have asked for nothing else, and they could have had anything I had to give them. But what I saw in their faces, and in the way they spoke when they crowded to praise me, was the thing I had heard being preached to artists, only I had never believed that any one human could mean it. They seemed to say that they owed me nothing, that their deafness had provided me with a moral goal, that it had been my duty to struggle, to suffer, to bear, for their sake, whatever sneers, contempt, injustice, torture they chose to inflict upon me, to bear it in order to teach them to enjoy my work, that this was their rightful due and my proper purpose. And then I understood the nature of the looter in spirit, a thing I had never been able to conceive. I saw them reaching into my soul, just as they reach into Mulligan's pocket, reaching to expropriate the value of my person, just as they reach to expropriate his wealth. I saw the impertinent malice of mediocrity boastfully holding up its own emptiness as an abyss to be filled by the bodies of its betters. I saw them seeking, just as they seek, to feed on Mulligan's money, to feed on those hours when I wrote my music and on that which made me write it, seeking to gnaw their way to self-esteem by extorting from me the admission that they were the goal of my music, so that precisely by reason of my achievement it would not be they who'd acknowledge my value, but I who would bow to theirs. It was that night that I took the oath never to let them hear another note of mine. The streets were empty when I left that theater. I was the last one to leave, and I saw a man whom I had never seen before, waiting for me in the light of a lamppost. He did not have to tell me much, but the concerto I dedicated to him is called the Concerto of Deliverance. She looked at the others. "Please tell me your reasons," she said, with a faint stress of firmness in her voice, as if she were taking a beating, but wished to take it to the end. "I quit when medicine was placed under state control some years ago," said Dr. Hendricks. "Do you know what it takes to perform a brain operation? Do you know the kind of skill it demands and the years of passionate, merciless, excruciating devotion that go to acquire that skill? That was what I would not place at the disposal of men whose sole qualification to rule me was their capacity to spout the fraudulent generalities that got them elected to the privilege of enforcing their wishes at the point of a gun. I would not let them dictate the purpose for which my years of study had been spent, or the conditions of my work, or my choice of patients, or the amount of my reward. I observed that in all the discussions that preceded the enslavement of medicine, men discussed everything, except the desires of the doctors. Men considered only the welfare of the patients, with no thought for those who were to provide it. That a doctor should have any right, desire, or choice in the matter was regarded as irrelevant selfishness. His is not to choose, they said, only to serve. That a man who's willing to work under compulsion is too dangerous a brute to entrust with a job in the stockyards never occurred to those who proposed to help the sick by making life impossible for the healthy. I have often wondered at the smugness with which people assert their right to enslave me, to control my work, to force my will, to violate my conscience, to stifle my mind. Yet what is it that they expect to depend on when they lie on an operating table under my hands? Their moral code has taught them to believe that it is safe to rely on the virtue of their victims. Well, that is the virtue I have withdrawn. Let them discover the kind of doctors that their system will now produce. Let them discover in their operating rooms and hospital wards that it is not safe to place their lives in the hands of a man whose life they have throttled. It is not safe, if he is the sort of man who resents it, and still less safe, if he is the sort who doesn't. I quit, said Alice Wyatt, because I didn't wish to serve as the cannibal's meal and to do the cooking besides. I discovered, said Ken Daniger, that the men I was fighting were impotent, the shiftless, the purposeless, the irresponsible, the irrational. It was not I who needed them. It was not theirs to dictate terms to me. It was not mine to obey demands. I quit to let them discover it too. I quit, said Quentin Daniels, because if there are degrees of damnation, the scientist who places his mind in the service of brute force is the longest-range murderer on Earth. They were silent. She turned to Galt. "And you?" she asked. "You were first."
What made you come to it?
He chuckled.
My refusal to be born with any original sin.
What do you mean?
I have never felt guilty of my ability. I have never felt guilty of my mind. I have never felt guilty of being a man. I accepted no unearned guilt, and thus was free to earn and to know my own value. Ever since I can remember, I had felt that I would kill the man who'd claimed that I exist for the sake of his need, and I had known that this was the highest moral feeling. That night, at the 20th century meeting, when I heard an unspeakable evil being spoken in a tone of moral righteousness, I saw the root of the world's tragedy, the key to it, and the solution. I saw what had to be done. I went out to do it.
And the motor? She asked. Why did you abandon it? Why did you leave it to the Starnes heirs?
It was their father's property. He paid me for it. It was made on his time. But I knew that it would be of no benefit to them, and that no one would ever hear of it again. It was my first experimental model. Nobody but me or my equivalent could have been able to complete it, or even to grasp what it was. And I knew that no equivalent of mine would come near that factory from then on.
You knew the kind of achievement your motor represented?
Yes.
And you knew you were leaving it to perish?
Yes. He looked off into the darkness beyond the windows and chuckled softly, but it was not a sound of amusement. I looked at my motor for the last time before I left. I thought of the men who claim that wealth is a matter of natural resources, and of the men who claim that wealth is a matter of seizing the factories, and of the men who claim that machines condition their brains. Well, there was the motor to condition them, and there it remained as just exactly what it is without man's mind, as a pile of metal scraps and wires going to rust. You have been thinking of the great service which that motor could have rendered to mankind, if it had been put into production. I think that on the day when men understand the meaning of its fate in that factory's junk heap, it will have rendered a greater one.
Did you expect to see that day when you left it?
No.
Did you expect a chance to rebuild it elsewhere?
No.
And you were willing to let it remain in a junk heap?
For the sake of what that motor meant to me, he said slowly, I had to be willing to let it crumble and vanish forever. He looked straight at her, and she heard the steady, unhesitant, uninflected ruthlessness of his voice. Just as you will have to be willing to let the rail of Taggart Transcontinental crumble and vanish. She held his eyes. Her head was lifted, and she said softly, in the tone of a proudly open plea,
Don't make me answer you now.
I won't. We'll tell you whatever you wish to know. We won't urge you to make a decision. He added, and she was shocked by the sudden gentleness of his voice, I said that that kind of indifference toward a world which should have been ours was the hardest thing to attain. I know. We've all gone through it. She looked at the quiet, impregnable room, and at the light that came from his motor, on the faces of men who were the most serene and confident gathering she had ever attended.
What did you do when you walked out of the 20th century? She asked.
I went out to become a flame spotter. I made it my job to watch for those bright flares in the growing night of savagery, which were the men of ability, the men of the mind, to watch their course, their struggle, and their agony, and to pull them out when I knew that they had seen enough.
What did you tell them to make them abandon everything?
I told them that they were right. In answer to the silent question of her glance, he added, I gave them the pride they did not know they had. I gave them the words to identify it. I gave them that priceless possession which they had missed, had longed for, yet had not known they needed. A moral sanction.
Did you call me the destroyer and the hunter of men? I was the walking delegate of this strike, the leader of the victims' rebellion, the defender of the oppressed, the disinherited, the exploited. And when I use these words, they have, for once, a literal meaning.
Who were the first to follow you?
He let a moment pass, in deliberate emphasis, then answered, My two best friends. You know one of them. You know, perhaps better than anyone else, what price he paid for it. Our own teacher, Dr. Axton, was next. He joined us within one evening's conversation. William Hastings, who had been my boss in the research laboratory of 20th Century Motors, had a hard time fighting it out with himself. It took him a year, but he joined. Then Richard Halley. Then Midas Mulligan. Who took 15 minutes, said Mulligan. She turned to him.
It was you who established this valley?
Yes, said Mulligan. It was just my own private retreat at first. I bought it years ago. I bought miles of these mountains, section by section, from ranchers and cattlemen who didn't know what they owned. The valley is not listed on any map. I built this house when I decided to quit. I cut off all possible avenues of approach except one road, and it's camouflaged beyond anyone's power to discover. And I stocked this place to be self-supporting, so that I could live here for the rest of my life and never have to see the face of a looter. When I heard that John had got Judge Narragansett, too, I invited the judge to come here. Then we asked Richard Halley to join us. The others remained outside at first.
We had no rules of any kind, said Galt, except one.
When a man took our oath, it meant a single commitment. Not to work in his own profession, not to give to the world the benefit of his mind. Each of us carried it out in any manner he chose. Those who had money retired to live on their savings. Those who had to work took the lowest jobs they could find. Some of us had been famous. Others, like that young brakeman of yours whom Halley discovered, were stopped by us before they had set out to get tortured. But we did not give up our minds or the work we loved. Each of us continued in his real profession, in whatever manner and spare time he could manage. But he did it secretly, for his own sole benefit, giving nothing to men, sharing nothing. We were scattered all over the country, as the outcasts we had always been, only now we accepted our parts with conscious intention. Our sole relief were the rare occasions when we could see one another. We found that we liked to meet, in order to be reminded that human beings still existed. So we came to set aside 1 month a year to spend in this valley, to rest, to live in a rational world, to bring our real work out of hiding, to trade our achievements. Here, where achievements meant payment, not expropriation. Each of us built his own house here at his own expense, for 1 month of life out of 12. It made the 11 easier to bear.
You see, Miss Taggart, said Hugh Axton, man is a social being, but not in the way the looters preach.
It's the destruction of Colorado that started the growth of this valley, said Midas Mulligan. Ellis Wyatt and the others came to live here permanently because they had to hide. Whatever part of their wealth they could salvage, they converted into gold or machines, as I had, and they brought it here. There were enough of us to develop the place and to create jobs for those who had had to earn their living outside. We have now reached the stage where most of us can live here full-time. The valley is almost self-supporting. And as to the goods that we can't yet produce, I purchase them from the outside through a pipeline of my own. It's a special agent, a man who does not let my money reach the looters. We are not a state here, not a society of any kind. We're just a voluntary association of men held together by nothing but every man's self-interest. I own the valley, and I sell the land to the others when they want it. Judge Narragansett is to act as our arbiter in case of disagreements. He hasn't had to be called upon as yet. They say that it's hard for men to agree. You'd be surprised how easy it is when both parties hold as their moral absolute that neither exists for the sake of the other, and that reason is their only means of trade. The time is approaching when all of us will have to be called to live here, because the world is falling apart so fast that it will soon be starving. But we will be able to support ourselves in this valley.
The world is crashing faster than we expected, said Hugh Axton. Men are stopping and giving up. Your frozen trains, the gangs of raiders, the deserters. They're men who've never heard of us, and they're not part of our strike. They are acting on their own. It's the natural response of whatever rationality is still left in them. It's the same kind of protest as ours.
We started with no time limit in view, said Galt. We did not know whether we'd live to see the liberation of the world or whether we'd have to leave our battle and our secret to the next generations. We knew only that this was the only way we cared to live. But now we think that we will see, and soon, the day of our victory and of our return.
When? She whispered.
When the code of the looters has collapsed. He saw her looking at him, her glance half question, half hope, and he added, when the creed of self-immolation has run for once its undisguised course, when men find no victims ready to obstruct the path of justice and to deflect the fall of retribution on themselves, when the preachers of self-sacrifice discover that those who are willing to practice it have nothing to sacrifice, and those who have are not willing any longer. When men see that neither their hearts nor their muscles can save them, but the mind they damned is not there to answer their screams for help. When they collapse as they must, as men without mind, when they have no pretense of authority left, no remnant of law, no trace of morality, no hope, no food, and no way to obtain it, when they collapse and the road is clear, then we'll come back to rebuild the world.
The Taggart Terminal, she thought.
She heard the words beating through the numbness of her mind as the sum of a burden she had not had time to weigh.
This was the Taggart Terminal, she thought. This room, not the giant concourse in New York. This was her goal, the end of track, the point beyond the curve of the earth where the two straight lines of rail met and vanished, drawing her forward, as they had drawn Nathaniel Taggart.
This was the goal Nathaniel Taggart had seen in the distance, and this was the point still holding the straight-line glance of his lifted head above the spiral motion of men in the granite concourse. It was for the sake of this that she had dedicated herself to the rail of Taggart Transcontinental, as to the body of a spirit yet to be found. She had found it. Everything she had ever wanted. It was here in this room, reached and hers. But the price was that net of rail behind her, the rail that would vanish, the bridges that would crumble, the signal lights that would go out. And yet, everything I had ever wanted, she thought, looking away from the figure of a man with sun-colored hair and implacable eyes. You don't have to answer us now. She raised her head. He was watching her as if he had followed the steps in her mind. We never demand agreement, he said. We never tell anyone more than he is ready to hear. You were the first person who has learned our secret ahead of time. But you're here, and you had to know. Now you know the exact nature of the choice you'll have to make. If it seems hard, it's because you still think that it does not have to be one or the other. You will learn that it does.
Will you give me time?
Your time is not ours to give. Take your time. You alone can decide what you'll choose to do and when. We know the cost of that decision. We've paid it. That you've come here might now make it easier for you. Or harder.
Harder, she whispered.
I know. He said it, his voice as low as hers, with the same sound of being forced past one's breath, and she missed an instant of time, as in stillness after a blow, because she felt that this, not the moments when he had carried her in his arms down the mountainside, but this meeting of their voices, had been the closest physical contact between them. A full moon stood in the sky above the valley when they drove back to his house. It stood like a flat, round lantern without rays, with a haze of light hanging in space, not reaching the ground, and the illumination seemed to come from the abnormal white brightness of the soil. In the unnatural stillness of sight without color, the earth seemed veiled by a film of distance. Its shapes did not merge into a landscape, but went slowly flowing past, like the print of a photograph on a cloud. She noticed suddenly that she was smiling. She was looking down at the houses of the valley. Their lighted windows were dimmed by a bluish cast. The outlines of their walls were dissolving. Long bands of mist were coiling among them in torpid, unhurried waves. It looked like a city sinking underwater. "What do they call this place?" she asked. "I call it Mulligan's Valley," he said. "The others call it Galt's Gulch." "I'd call it..." But she did not finish. He glanced at her. She knew what he saw in her face. He turned away. She saw a faint movement of his lips, like the release of a breath that he was forcing to function. She dropped her glance, her arm falling against the side of the car, as if her hand were suddenly too heavy for the weakness in the crook of her elbow. The road grew darker as it went higher, and pine branches met over their heads. Above a slant of rock moving to meet them, she saw the moonlight on the windows of his house. Her head fell back against the seat, and she lay still, losing awareness of the car, feeling only the motion that carried her forward, watching the glittering drops of water in the pine branches, which were the stars. When the car stopped, she did not permit herself to know why she did not look at him as she stepped out. She did not know that she stood still for an instant, looking up at the dark windows. She did not hear him approach, but she felt the impact of his hands with shocking intensity, as if it were the only awareness she could now experience. He lifted her in his arms and started slowly up the path to the house. He walked, not looking at her, holding her tight, as if trying to hold a progression of time, as if his arms were still locked over the moment when he had lifted her against his chest. She felt his steps as if they were a single span of motion to a goal, and as if each step were a separate moment in which she dared not think of the next. Her head was close to his hair brushing her cheek, and she knew that neither of them would move his face that one breath closer. It was a sudden, stunned state of quiet drunkenness, complete in itself. Their hair mingled like the rays of two bodies in space that had achieved their meeting. She saw that he walked with his eyes closed, as if even sight would now be an intrusion. He entered the house, and as he moved across the living room, he did not look to his left, and neither did she. But she knew that both of them were seeing the door on his left that led to his bedroom. He walked the length of the darkness to the wedge of moonlight that fell across the guest room bed. He placed her down upon it. She felt an instant's pause of his hands still holding her shoulder and waistline, and when his hands left her body, she knew that the moment was over. He stepped back and pressed a switch, surrendering the room to the harshly public glare of light. He stood still, as if demanding that she look at him, his face expectant and stern. "Have you forgotten that you wanted to shoot me on sight?" he asked. It was the unprotected stillness of his figure that made it real. The shudder that threw her upright was like a cry of terror and denial, but she held his glance and answered evenly, "That's true. I did." "Then stand by it." Her voice was low. Its intensity was both a surrender and a scornful reproach. "You know better than that, don't you?" He shook his head. "No. I want you to remember that that had been your wish. You were right in the past. So long as you were part of the outer world, You had to seek to destroy me. And of the two courses now open to you, one will lead you to the day when you will find yourself forced to do it. She did not answer. She sat looking down. He saw the strands of her hair swing jerkily as she shook her head in desperate protest. You are my only danger. You are the only person who could deliver me to my enemies. If you remain with them, you will. Choose that if you wish, but choose it with full knowledge. Don't answer me now. But until you do, the stress of severity in his voice was the sound of effort directed against himself. Remember that I know the meaning of either answer. As fully as I do.